Good morning. We're here for the scheduled meeting of creditors in the jointly administered cases of the SCO Group, Inc. et al., case number 07-11337, and the judge assigned to the case is Judge Gross of the Bankruptcy Court. My name is Joseph McMahon. I'm a trial attorney with the Office of the United States Trustee, and I'm the trial attorney assigned to these cases, and I will be leading the meeting this morning. With me from the U.S. Trustee's office in the meeting room is Michael Panaccio, who's the bankruptcy analyst working with me on the cases. Jamie O'Neill, debtor's counsel, is here from the law firm of Pacholsky, Stang, Zeal, and Jones. And I will ask him to introduce his co-counsel that are present here today and also the witness for the record.
Thank you, Joe. I'm here with Rachel Werkheiser, also from my firm, and with our co-counsel, Arthur Spector. And from the company, we have Darrell McBride, who's the chief executive officer, and Gene Atchison, who is the controller.
Can I have the spelling of Gene's name?
Gene is J-E-A-N, Atchison, A-C-H-E-S-O-N.
Mr. McBride, will you please raise your right hand, sir?
Yes.
Do you swear the testimony you will give today will be the truth and the whole truth under penalty of perjury?
Yes.
Thank you. Put your hand
down,
sir.
You want to swear in Jean Atchison, too? She's the one
well,
who
the question,
schedules.
I appreciate that. I guess the question is controller a director or officer position with the SCO? Because if it is not, then that person is, I guess, not an authorized representative of the company.
Would you have any problem if the questions relate to financial information that he turns to Gene, but probably knows the answers?
To the extent that the company is willing to consent to Ms. Atchison being sworn in and testifying on the record today for that purpose, I have no problem taking the testimony, but my expectation is that Mr. McBride will be the primary witness. That's acceptable.
I think that's fine. Ms. Atchison, as controller of the company, has the most detailed view of the information contained in the schedules and statements. They were prepared at Mr. McBride's direction and under his supervision, so he's knowledgeable as well. But she should be able to assist with information on the schedules and statements.
I will direct my questions first to Mr. McBride, and to the extent that he can't answer questions, we'll look to Ms. Ashton for those responses.
Fine.
Mr. McBride, what's your title with SCO?
Right, I'm Chief Executive Officer and President of the SCO Group.
And how long have you held both of those titles?
I've held both of them since I joined the company in June of 2002. I believe it was June 26th.
Prior to becoming employed with SCO, where were you employed?
I had a few different jobs. I, out of graduate school, went and worked at Texas Instruments in Dallas. Went to Utah, worked at Novell for 8 years. After that, worked for a company back this way, Icon Office Solutions, for a few years. Did a few technology startups and then got recruited to come and be CEO here. Most recently, before coming to SCO, I was the president of FranklinPlanner.com. It was senior vice president role of Franklin Covey Incorporated.
You referenced tech startups as a group.
Yeah.
Were you an officer or director with any of those startups?
Yes. There was a company called SBI, Inc. that I was chairman, chief executive for a period of time. Later moved into just a shareholder role. Franklin Covey role. I was also an officer of the company.
At any point in your employment background, were you ever terminated for cause?
No.
Have any of the companies before arriving at SCO that you were a director or officer of ever filed for bankruptcy protection?
No.
I'm going to start with some specific questions regarding the schedules and the statements which the debtors filed. If we take a look at the schedules for operations. Now, take a look at the cash line for Schedule B. It indicates there's about $2.68 million in cash as of petition date. Do you have an understanding as to what the current figure is?
We went through this morning. Gene, maybe you could educate me as to where that number is going.
Ms. Atchison, if you could just raise your right hand. And do you swear the testimony you will give today will be the truth and the whole truth under penalty of perjury?
Yes, I do.
You can put your hand down.
I'm sorry, I don't have the exact number at this point.
Do you know whether it's north of $2 million or less?
I honestly don't know at the moment. I'd have to check that.
Okay. Well, if I were to back up and ask you as of last Friday or the last day you saw a report on that figure.
Yeah, I usually look at the accounts in individual. I'm sorry, I just haven't seen a complete total. We were in the point of reconciling our books when I left the company, or just, you know, to go on this trip.
Okay.
We've had several people leaving the company, and we're a little behind.
I understand. Any idea what the figure was as of the end of September?
At the moment, I don't. I'm sorry.
Can you give me a call? We can find that out later.
Yeah, I can just find it out. I probably have it online.
That's fine. Now, you're the controller. How big is the company's accounting department?
Well, it used to be about seven people, and then we went down to three due to attrition. And we've gotten back in two people to help.
They're temporary hires?
They were immediate hires. One is a temporary, and one we hired permanently. The temporary will probably become permanent.
Who do you report to?
I report to the CFO.
Taking a look at line B16A. There is reference to the SCO trade accounts receivable in the amount of $3.64 million. Do you see that?
Yes.
Do you have an understanding as to what percentage of those are SCO source related receivables as opposed to other?
The receivables in that statement now are all receivables for the main core business for Unix or for our mobility products. I do not believe there's any SCO source open at this time on our aging.
Okay. Do you have a view as to the collectability of that amount as a general matter?
Probably about 95%. We have a very tight core of customers, which are mostly distributors and resellers.
Okay. In terms of the aging, do you have any ideas to what percentage of that is, I guess, has been due for more than 90 days?
There's approximately, I think at the moment there's approximately 400,000 that is over 90 days, and that is mainly due to either non-cash offsets like foreign withholding certificates, which we're waiting on, or collections in from countries that it's harder to get cash through, such as India.
I noted that your 10Q for the period ending July 31st indicating about an $87,000 allowance for doubtful accounts mm-hmm. receivable. So I gather that your testimony today is that figure is would be about accurate.
It would be accurate, or it might be even a little high at this moment since it's a carry forward. Our revenue has dipped a little bit. It would be reevaluated again at the end of fourth quarter, which is October 31st.
Okay. Now, the intercompany receivables line, if we take a look at that exhibit. Mm-hmm. The exhibit indicates that group owes operations $1.75 million, roughly. Can you explain the nature or the basis of that obligation?
Basically, it's I believe the investments, I'm just kind of learning some of this myself, the investments through and the funding from all of the intercompany accounts. We fund back and forth, and then the entire intercompany line between the receivables and the payables zeros out on the set of books.
Okay. So, SCO operations, do I understand that to be the operating debtor? Would that be it?
Yes.
Okay.
Most everything goes through SCO operations and then rolls up into SCO group.
And given that group is the holding company mm-hmm. together, I'm just trying to get a sense of what's wrapped into that $1.75 million figure. Why would SCO Group owe operations that amount?
I can find that out for you.
You don't know offhand?
No, I don't. These are transactions that took place prior to my taking this position, and I'm still learning a lot of this.
When did you become a controller?
Within the past month.
Okay. Are you affiliated with a temporary agency? Or?
No, I did work for the company before, but as the director of revenue.
Okay.
And she's been with the company for 12?
I started with AT&T.
Okay.
So I kind of followed
the
product line.
She's been a lot of years, yeah.
If we take a look at Schedule E, unsecured priority claims. Now, all the tax obligations are listed as having an unknown amount.
These are mainly sales tax.
I guess my question is, what period or periods do these various taxes cover? We're just talking about 2007.
It depends on the particular state. We're
sure.
current in all of our filings
okay.
with the state, so it's only the month or couple of months that may be due since their last filing rotation.
Right. So to the extent that a state would have a quarterly...
Right, or a six-month or whatever obligation.
The balance of that amount would be due and owing.
Correct.
All right. Just to give me an idea on an annual basis, do you have any idea what SCO pays out in first in terms of state income tax and then in terms of sales tax?
State income tax, I do not know. I do know that we have an accrual currently for state taxes for about $18,000. Once again, we sell through distribution. So our obligation is usually quite low. I can find the income taxes for you.
Okay. With respect to the next exhibit to it, which it identifies I guess certain, aside from these employee stock purchase plan,
mm-hmm.
And my question there is, I don't know if counsel wants to, are those trust funds? Claims for trust fund amounts?
Which are you talking about?
The employee stock purchase plan amount.
I don't know whether we're in a position to really respond to that. I don't know that we've examined it. This is amounts voluntarily withheld.
Right. It's just a stock purchase plan. We hold the funds, and then end of every 6 month period in the plan rotation, we purchase stock for the employees at a 15% discount.
But I don't think it's subject to a trust, is it?
No, I don't think so. I think we just
hold
it.
And then we purchase it.
Yeah.
The plan defines the, I guess, the
yes.
obligation.
There is the plan that basically governs the, so you, the cash stays there until you purchase the stock, right?
Mm-hmm. I'd like to make a request to see just a copy of the purchase plan.
Okay,
sure.
Is that something that's an exhibit to your filings, the SEC?
It would be with the proxy statement.
I think you can get that.
I can take a look at that and
okay.
grab it. The other question I have, and this is directed to counsel, is just for notice purposes, I query whether it would be appropriate to list the employees who had these various claims in this category in an individual basis in zero amount, just for notice purposes. In other words,
to give them notice as
exactly that the debtors believe that they don't owe them anything, because in this circumstance, I don't think they can, you know, the debtors made that blanket statement, but I wonder whether the people whose pre-petition claims were, mm-hmm. per the debtor's position, paid, would be getting notice and a claims bar date.
Well, they would, because I believe they're on our matrix, and I can mm-hmm. confirm that. I think what you are also thinking about is whether they should be listed as part of a schedule with a zero amount owed, so that if they dispute that, they could file some kind of a claim.
Exactly.
And we can talk about whether it's appropriate to make that kind
amendment.
Of amendment.
Fine. If I could just get your response to that, say, within 15 days.
That's fine.
This meeting.
Now, if you take a look at Schedule F,
there's just a footnote on the last page. It's page 3 of 3 of the schedule. It references fringe benefits that are due as of the filing date.
Mm-hmm.
Any ideas to what the amount of those fringe benefits
I think
were?
It was rolled into here. It was as a group number. Let's see. I'm going to have to flip it. Okay. I just don't remember exactly how we put it in here. Yeah, fringe on the first page.
Yes.
There's under name fringe benefits.
Okay.
And it's basically
That $273,000.
Yes. What we do is we accrue fringe based on a percentage of salary.
So that amount is all inclusive of the various obligations that are listed.
Correct.
I guess my next question is why that's not broken out for purposes of the schedule.
I think it's just the way the accounting was done on it, that, as I said, we accrue on a percentage of salary. And then as the invoicing comes in, we just negate against it, and we just didn't have a specific breakout on it at the point in time when we were doing this. I can work on getting one, though.
Point for counsel, same question as to notice now, whether a letter is going to be sent to fringe benefits and whatever address it is. I guess my concern is that the individual companies.
Well, we can discuss that also, and also discuss how the number was generated, because it could be that it sounds like the number was generated for accrual purposes to get a number, and then as actuals come in, they're booked. So this is probably some kind of an accrual estimate rather than an actual liability.
The debtors can inquire as to what the actual amount is. That's not so much my concern in asking the question as ensuring that the individual entities are getting a claims notice.
Okay. I have two other thoughts. Number one is, if these are employee fringe benefits, why aren't they in Schedule E? And that's something I'll probably have to ask Mesero when they did the Mesero help do the schedules with Ms. Atchison. But it would seem to me fringe benefits is something that should have been on E, not on F, but I'll check into that.
Okay.
And the second thing is, it might be that these benefits were already paid as part of the court's order allowing the payment of fringe benefits and the like in the first day orders.
That was going to be another.
Good
point. It's well taken. And for the record, that was Mr. Spector speaking in the event this meeting is transcribed. So
we'll look into that, because those questions aren't answerable either. I'll have to check into that.
So we have three questions. And this is Jamie O'Neill talking again on the fringe benefit item. We're going to provide some further details, consider notice requirement, evaluate whether they should be Schedule E or Schedule F, and then also I guess we could footnote whether there were in fact or a portion of them was paid in connection with orders of the court on the first day.
Those are my questions for the schedules with respect to operations.
Okay.
We turn to the Statement of Financial Affairs for operations. The attachments, Exhibit 3B. Just in terms of how the debtor's accounting system works, I have a question. Would they be able to run a payment list that showed the date that the checks were issued as opposed to cleared?
Yes.
Okay.
Actually, it would be easier.
Right.
But this was.
If it were done that way.
Yeah.
Okay, so.
For what period of time? 90 days also?
That's my question. I don't know necessarily whether the date the check was drawn would be dispositive.
The clear date usually for a preference, right?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I just want to get an understanding as to what records would be available in that regard. Another question I have about this exhibit is Kevin McBride is listed as one of the people here. Can you explain? Does he have a relationship?
Yes, he's my brother.
He's your brother? What's his employment?
He is an outside attorney working on the case. He started off as an attorney, and then he rolled into more of a legal support that does basically the technology, the document management system that supports all of the litigation.
Okay. How long has he been doing work for Scale?
Since 2002.
Okay. Is he employed with a firm, or is he a private practitioner, or a solo practitioner?
He is a solo practitioner. Okay. He has a small company that he runs there that does all this document management.
Well, what's the name of that company?
Well, I believe he goes under McBride Law.
Okay.
And he is listed on all of our SEC filings and has been since, I believe, 2003.
And when he's paid in connection with the payments to creditors, is he just being paid for legal services? Is that?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Okay. Now, if we take a look at Schedule 3C, if we could go back to 3B, I just have some questions regarding specific entities. First, the payment to cash for 13.6 on 9/13. What? Can you explain that transaction for me?
No, at the moment, I cannot. I have to look into that.
We discussed this briefly at the IDI as well.
Mm-hmm.
We agreed we'd provide information regarding that to your office.
Right. Christine Bodison? Any idea who she is? Ms. McBride? Actually, the schedule.
Let's see. I believe she is on the expert. She's part of the legal, the litigation fees that go out on the Boies-Schuller case. I think she's an expert witness.
With respect to the Novell?
Novell/IBM, I'm not sure which one. I think it's one of those two. She's either an expert or an attorney in support of the litigation, is my recollection.
Thank you. Same question as to Coltrane Associates.
Coltrane Associates is our PR firm.
Do you know what the terms of their retention are? Are they paid on an hourly, flat fee basis?
They are paid on a retention basis, and I can't remember exactly the terms. I recall it's X amount per month, I want to say.
Just for your purposes, and this is Jamie O'Neill again, we recently filed our Ordinary Course Professionals motion and listed them as one of the professionals and with the expected monthly cap of $15,000 per month for their services based on, I believe, prior expense. Mm-hmm. And we can provide a little more detail for you in terms of what the nature of the compensation is.
Do you have an understanding as to why Looks like they were paid $50,000 on September 13, 2007, after being paid $15,000.
I know that when
3 weeks earlier.
I know that when the Novell litigation came out the way it did on the August 10th ruling, there was a plan to go to market with our mobility products, and as we got into September, it was basically expected that there was going to be huge amounts of PR load once we made our bankruptcy filing, and so the idea was that the retention would, there would be more hours packed into a compressed period of time to cover all of the PR needs that were going to go on.
Okay. Do you know if those two payments that are listed on this exhibit are for current services? In other words, the payments for services rendered within 2 months of the bankruptcy filing? Any idea?
My understanding was that I didn't know that there were two payments. My understanding was that there was a compression of the payments we would make, so we pulled their services in from the end of October, what we'd normally pay to cover the PR needs we were going to have during this period of time. I don't remember exactly the dates or how that played out, per se. But I'm not sure where we stand on them right now, and we have the thing that Jamie just mentioned on a go-forward basis.
Gary Pisano,
expert slash legal professional in the IBM slash Novell litigation.
GRE Mountain Heights.
I believe that's the landlord for our New Jersey facility.
Okay.
I will verify that.
I think you're right. Well, that's right, because that's the mountain.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Thanks.
The amount, at least.
Talk about the insider payments. Let's take a look at before turning to schedule, to 3C issues, payments to insiders, is the company's intention to employ your brother going forward as an attorney?
When I believe the intention is to continue with the services he's providing on the litigation support side, which is the document management system. So I think whether it's as an attorney or as document manager, I'm not sure how that lines on. He is an attorney,
okay.
But I'm not sure. I know that they have strong needs for, you know, the millions of documents that are in the system that he has, that he manages. So I would expect that that would be I go forward.
Okay.
Case.
On Exhibit 3C, payments to insiders within a year prior to the bankruptcy case. Couple of questions. First, is there a reason why the schedule was prepared with the kind of like aggregate amounts listed as opposed to specific payments and dates upon which those checks were drawn?
This is the way Mesereau understood it needed to be prepared.
Okay. That may be.
Would it be helpful to list those out?
I think it would be.
Okay, I can give you a detail.
Just because if from this you can't get a sense of timing or, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Do to the extent that someone would want to file an action challenging, saying what it was they were going after. Now, just some to back out and get some big picture here, Mr. McBride. The debtors' board of directors, as of the petition date.
Yes.
We would go to groups. Statement of Financial Affairs, number 21, and I'll just. Yes. If you were to take a look at. The debtor's response to that. Could you confirm for me that who the debtor's board, who were the members of the debtor's board of directors as of the petition date?
Sure. As of the petition date, it would be I'll read them off. So Dan Campbell, Darcy Mott, Darrell McBride, Kent Millington, Omar Lehman, Duff Thompson, and Ralph Yarrow.
Moving forward from the petition date to today, have there been any changes in that composition?
No, sir.
If we take a look at that schedule, there are a couple, one or two shareholders listed as having more than a 5% holdings. And then for the remainder of them, there's the NA listed.
Right.
I just want to get clarify for the record, does that NA mean that none of those persons that are listed hold 5% of the company's equity?
Yeah, yes.
Okay.
Yes, that's what I'm saying.
Now, as of the petition date, did SCO Group, the board of directors, have a compensation committee?
Yes.
Who's on it?
Compensation committee would be consisted of Kent Millington, Omar Lehman, and Duff Thompson at the point that we filed. It's been that way for a while.
Look at the schedule. Now, does Mr. Yarrow have the right to designate a certain number of directors? No.
I don't know for certain, but I believe he has two. I know that in the previous incarnation of where the stock came from, I believe that's what the relationship was, when they moved the stock from the Canopy Group to Ralph personally, I don't know if that continued on or not. It may not have.
With respect to the two, is it himself and another person?
Yes.
The other person. In your belief, who was that?
The other person, historically, going back to the original ownership group with the Canopy Group, would have been Darcy Mott.
Okay. Should we check the bylaws or whatever to confirm all of that? Or?
It's probably worth following up on. I don't know that that's... I don't think it does survive, actually, because he's not part of an entity. Or he just owns stock at this point. So I think that's how it started, but I don't think that's... I think right now they're just independent directors, actually.
Okay.
Well, going back to minus the stock ownership. So right now it's Yarrow that holds the... So the other guy, I believe Darcy would be independent.
Do you have an understanding as to how often the compensation committee of the board meets.
It's not a regularly scheduled thing per se. I mean, it's on a quarterly basis, or I think we meet every other month. There are meetings that happen pretty regularly. I'd say they meet once or twice a quarter.
Okay. Are minutes kept of those meetings? Do you know?
I believe so.
And where are those minutes stored?
They would be held by our corporate counsel, who is actually outside counsel with Dorsey and Whitney. His name is Nolan Taylor.
Okay. And does he have a Salt Lake office?
Yes.
He does. Okay. And is that the case for board of directors meeting
yes.
minutes generally?
Yes. Mm-hmm. And then he consolidates those back up through our filings and, well, they don't all get filed, but he basically is responsible for working with our team here on the filings and keeping track of and holding those minutes.
Okay. The board of directors sets officer salaries, correct?
Yes.
And it did so during the year prior to the bankruptcy filing, is that correct?
Yes.
Okay. So, if we take a look at Exhibit 3C,
yes.
And it lists payments to insiders, the bonus column.
Right.
Are you familiar with the terms on which bonuses are paid to officers?
Yes.
Okay. The payments that are made in that column, the bonus column.
Yes.
Right here in the exhibit. Mm-hmm. Do you understand the basis for the payments or the triggering events, the reasons why the payments were made?
Yes.
Can you explain that to me?
The general bonus plan we're on is what we call a 40-40-20 plan.
Okay.
And 40% is triggered by revenue attainment, 40% by net income attainment, and 20% by MBO attainment, management by objectives. So basically a sort of a qualitative set of objectives. And so what happens is at the beginning of each fiscal year, we set targets, and then we measure them quarterly, and depending on the attainment of those targets, you'll get a bonus or not, depending on where it comes in. So there's the revenue threshold, and then it goes to the net income, then to the MBOs.
So is it your testimony then that all of the payments under the bonus column on that Exhibit 3C are the product of your 40-40-20 plan?
As I'm looking at this right now, I think I can see one exception that I'm familiar with in the case of Mr. Tibbetts. He was paid a bonus that was outside of that plan. I think that's the only one I can target on here right now.
Okay. And to be clear,
may I just ask one question? You're not on the compensation committee, though, or are you on the compensation committee?
No, I'm not on the committee.
Okay. So if you don't know the answer, if you don't know all of the answers to these questions, find out.
Well, there's two separate things going on here. I'm asking the witness questions based upon his knowledge. Okay, now whether he believes that he has personal knowledge to answer the question and is answering it, whether or not it the witness's testimony is in fact accurate, I guess would be a different question. But we're here to get the witness's testimony. If Mr. McBride thinks he can answer the question, that's fine. If debtor's counsel hears the testimony and disagrees with it or has a different view, I'd be glad to hear you after I ask the question, but just out of curiosity, what prompts your response?
Because I think Mr. McBride is trying to be helpful and to respond to your questions.
Sure.
And they're obviously directed in a particular area of inquiry. And
this testimony is being given to provide information based on his knowledge. He can answer that question, and he's trying to be helpful. So I just want to make clear that it's based on his knowledge, and I just didn't want to see it at some other time saying,
well,
the debtor's testimony is that it's on the 40-40-20, and therefore...
I don't think that there's any misapprehension here amongst lawyers that the witness can only testify as to what he knows about. If he doesn't know or can't understand the question, I'm sure Mr. McBride will tell me that. And he also runs the company.
No, that's very true. These are areas of inquiry, and parties may be interested in them, so okay. The witness can certainly testify based on his knowledge.
Okay. The payments to and just to circle back to the point you made about Mr. Tibbetts,
yes.
Is that the recent bonus that was referenced in there was an SEC-8K filed within the last month or so?
That's exactly what it was.
Okay.
I mean, it was whatever's in that SEC filing would be the delta spread between his 40-40-20 plan and what this number here is.
Okay. Now, for Mr. Olson and Mr. Young,
yes.
there were $60,000 apiece paid for independent contractor fees that are referenced on that schedule?
Correct.
All right. And if I were to go back to, I think, the document listing payments to creditors, those checks were drawn on 9/14, the
correct.
Petition date.
Correct.
What services were those individuals providing as independent contractors?
Sure, I'll be glad to take that on. After our August 10th ruling, we came under severe pressure of people exiting the company, and a lot of people had opportunities that started to come up, and these two particular individuals had opportunities to leave. And losing your CFO and controller simultaneously when you're getting ready to file bankruptcy isn't exactly the best news for a CEO when you wake up in the morning. So we tried to look at what our options were, being an SEC reporting company, having requirements to have a CFO in place, 10-K that's coming up within the next few months. There were just a number of things crashing down on us at once. We looked at a couple of options. One was to sort of outsource this whole thing to an agency, and we looked at the price tag that went with that, and it was extremely high. I can't remember the numbers right now, but it was in the hundreds of thousands of dollars over the next few months. We then came up with a second plan, which was to basically contract with these two individuals to ensure that we get through our year-end close, and then to go to a third person to come in and become the CFO immediately at a much reduced price than what this outsourced firm was going to charge. So from a standpoint of how we move forward against, the issues we had with this, we viewed this to be the best option. So I guess that was a long-winded answer to get to the simple question you asked, which is, what service are they providing? It is to allow us to finish this year off, get through the end of the year, get our 10-K filed in a timely fashion, and to go through our year-end audit. So all of those things are big deals for us as a public company.
The independent contractor agreements, are they in writing?
I'm sure they are.
Okay.
Yes. Yes.
Were they approved by the board of directors?
They were. The board, I am representing to you what the board approved. And again, this is, to Jamie's point, fair to go back and, nitpick a little bit what I said. I believe I tried to give you the best representation of what happened there. But That's my understanding of it.
Do you know when the contracts were signed up?
I know that they were approved somewhere in that early part of September prior to the 14th, but I don't know exactly the... It would have been that week, I suspect.
And what are the compensation terms provided to these individuals? Is it hourly, flat monthly fee?
I believe we calculated off from an hourly fee that ran through the end of the year, and but I'm not certain on that. I have to go back and look. I think it was
okay.
I think it was an hourly fee calculated over X number of hours that added up to the amounts we're talking about.
Well, the company filed for bankruptcy protection on September 14th, correct?
Mm-hmm. Yes, that's correct.
And Mr. Both Mr. Let's just start with Mr. Young.
Yes.
He got his first payment draw of $60,000 on that date, correct?
I don't know for sure, but that would not surprise me. Is that... That sounds right. Okay.
The 8K that the company filed...
Yes.
...indicated that... On September 25th, he informed the board that he would be resigning, effective as of October 9th. I guess my question is, well, first, what is the... How do you separate the services that he's providing as independent contractor from the regular salary that he's receiving as an employee up until the point of his termination?
The compensation committee that basically agreed on this have the details of... I'm trying to give you the recollection I have, which is through the year end. The actual board call or the comp committee call where they approved this, I was actually on a plane and I was not privy to the exact discussion of the details you're asking for, so I can't be totally specific, but it's generally my understanding that it goes through the end of the year.
Maybe what we can do is provide that information to you after we find out some more.
But I... but the dynamic I find to be interesting as well, though. Did the compensation committee ask for your input on whether these independent contractor agreements with these two individuals were necessary or appropriate?
The review on the financial side of this, again, as I recall. That was not a committee call that I was on when they made those decisions.
Okay.
I was aware that these discussions were going on because I was shocked at the amount that the other, you know, independent consulting thing was going to cost us. So I was aware that it was going on. But again, down to the detail level of how they set the amounts and the kind of the agreements per se, I wasn't involved directly in setting those.
There's a couple things there. First, the answer to my question is no, they didn't. They didn't ask. Is that correct?
Right.
Right. Second, you said you were shocked at the amount that they were paying the other independent contractor.
That we would have had to pay.
Had you not done this.
The order of magnitude of these two $60,000 payments plus what we ended up paying the CFO are much lower than what the alternative was.
Okay. But you can't tell me sitting here whether what the $60,000 covers. Is it the month of September? Is it all in through the end of the reporting period? Do you have an understanding of
that? I don't have the exact, but I do know that in the case of Mike Olson, in our discussions, I know that he's going to aid us in preparing all the way through the 10K, which is in January.
Okay. Well, my question is, as the company controller, obviously you're involved in making projections and stuff
yes.
like that. Any ideas to what this is costing the company?
I believe it's maybe around $10,000 a month. I mean, we've already paid it from a cash flow perspective. So I believe it's, you know, for, as I said, the next several months. I'll check exactly.
Okay.
I have not projected any further payments.
They've already stated that they believe it's in writing. The payment is in writing.
So I'm sure it's in. Yeah,
that might
sure.
be the best, you know,
yeah, we'll
best
get
evidence.
We'll review it.
Yeah. Okay. We'll do that.
Well, that was our perspective at that last comment.
Do the... while we have counsel commenting on that, do the debtors have a view as to whether they'll be seeking approval of those contracts?
All those first we're going to inquire into the details. I haven't seen the contracts. The contracts may be pre-petition contracts. The question then is, are they executory contracts? And if they're executory contracts, maybe they should have been on Schedule G. I'm catching on to this
sure.
now myself. So if the answer to this question is, oh, these are pre-petition contracts and there's still duties outstanding by the debtor, then they would be executory. Then we'd have to amend to include those as executory contracts. On the other hand, I just picked up what you just picked up, and Ms. Atchison said they've already been prepaid their pay for that period of time. It may not be an executory contract. It may be that there's nothing owing by the debtor at all. And even if they didn't pay, if the only obligation of the debtor is to pay cash, question whether that's an executory contract also. But all those questions are legal questions that will work out once I have the facts.
Okay. I'd just like to get an answer to whatever your position is within a 15-day.
What is the question that you're asking?
Well,
what's up with
everything,
this?
Everything. Couldn't have said it better than the way counsel just put it.
Well, okay, I didn't know
what your position is with respect to whether the contracts are executory and whether court approval of those contracts is necessary. All right, those two questions.
Court approval of a pre-petition?
I'm sorry. Excuse me. I'm sorry. There's two separate lines of inquiry here, I guess. First, the question is whether or not the contract is, in fact, executory, whether there would be any continuing obligations imposed on the debtor.
Mm-hmm.
I'd like to know whether or not, after I've been provided with a copy of the contract, whether the debtor believes that the contract is executory.
Okay.
Right. If it is, then I guess the question is, the second question I would have is whether they intend to assume contracts.
And we're going to be on the level of academic, which is where we are, because we don't have the facts.
Right.
We're going to be
a
level
Fine.
Of academic. The next question is, even if it's executory, a debtor doesn't have to assume or reject.
Yeah, we don't. let's just find out what the facts are first.
Yeah.
I mean,
sure.
obviously,
That's
executory
fine.
Contracts don't have to be assumed for quite some time, so or whether they even can be.
I understand that.
So the answer is, what's up is the better question.
Sure.
Let's get the facts, and the questions will arise once we have the facts.
That's fine. The subsidiary funding. That's listed there on that schedule?
Yes.
Are there any current or former employees of the debtors that are deriving or did derive any income from a connection or relationship with one of the debtors' non-debtor affiliates is my question. In other words, you know, you're an employee of the SCO Group. There are other, you know, hundreds of them.
Mm-hmm.
And the answer would be no, not that I'm aware of.
Okay. taking a look at Exhibit 3C, did you know which employees listed there have employment contracts?
The answer to that would be zero.
None. Aside from the 40-40-20 program that you described to me,
right,
do the debtors have any other bonus or retention plans in place? Can we just go off the record for
sure.
A second? Okay, we're back on the record. I'm sorry. I just had to go off to answer an inquiry from my office. I'm sorry, I asked the question as to whether, aside from the 40-40-20 plan, there are any bonus plans or programs presently in place, to your knowledge.
And anything that we have would be in our latest proxy. There is a plan, not just for executives, but for employees, that relates to the stock ownership, the stock option plan, whereby under a change of control, there's an acceleration of some of the stock options. The details of that plan would be in the proxy. I can't think of anything else offhand.
Can
you think of anything?
Well, just we have commissioned sales representatives.
Yeah, commissioned sales plans.
But there are no outside.
Those get reviewed quarterly.
If there are any others, we'll get back to you on that. These people may not be the only ones that were doing this stuff.
If there is a plan, yeah, it will be in the proxy. If there is an approved
and that's public
bonus plan, it will be in
right
the proxy.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, there's outside of what is in the proxy, what I can state is there isn't anything.
What I would appreciate knowing going forward is if there was an incentive or a retention plan that was implemented by the debtors, even if the debtors believed that it was ordinary course, within the ordinary course of the
business. We'll get to that.
I would just like notice of its.
Right. It's part of the motions that are pending, right?
We have a motion pending, but we're looking for that.
Right.
But that.
But we'll look into that, and if there's something in writing, we'll give it to you.
I think we started.
It's a severance plan.
Yeah.
And right.
Severance plan is what it was. Because the other one just went into, I think we just came back and said we're just going to live with the 40-40-20 plan.
Right. Severance plan is what I think we're talking about.
Right.
So I guess the request is going forward, retention, incentive, or severance plans, regardless of whether the debtors intend to seek court approval. But we would just like our office to receive notice so we can evaluate that issue. And that's acceptable for the debtor.
Sure.
I'm not sure that can you just tell me, I want to make sure that I understand the question.
Sure.
I mean, obviously, to the extent that you would receive notice if we seek to approve some kind of a incentive plan, because we would file a motion to do it. Are you asking for?
Well, the debtors may unilaterally make a decision not to seek.
That's ordinary
court
course
court plan on grounds that it is ordinary course. And all I'm asking for is the courtesy of notice of the fact that you are implementing that ordinary course plan.
So basically, what you're saying is
so that we can evaluate whether or not we agree with your assessment that it is ordinary course.
You're basically saying even if it's like the regular, what we would consider to be a regular 40-40-20 plan, that we come back and say, here's our 40-40-20 plan, or are you
correct
saying to be on
or and I'm sure the council will discuss with you, there are, I guess, some other types of plans that are more typical to the bankruptcy scenario, but that's all I'm asking for.
Yeah, there is a provision in the bankruptcy that we're dealing with that they call KERPS, Key Employment Retention Programs. It's now structured by the bankruptcy code as what you can do and what you cannot do. And, of course, if we were going to implement such a program, we'd have to keep that in mind and so forth. But we can discuss that offline.
The just out of curiosity, the amounts that are listed there for the funding. I guess UK received $2 million in funding during the year prior to the petition date. Germany, about 1.18 million, and then there's some lesser amounts for the other, or certain of the other non-debtor affiliates. What were those amounts used by those various entities to do?
It's basically, it's to run an office in each of those locations. So it would be rent, expenses, salary for the employees that are there, and travel, just the normal course operating expenses.
Okay, and pursuant to the debtor's cash management system, the revenues that those non-debtor affiliates generated would flow back up to?
Yes, they actually mostly flow directly through SCO operations to begin with. All sales of products and the majority of services go through SCO operations.
Okay. It's not going to be reflected on these schedules, but if I wanted to get a breakdown on a non-debtor entity by non-debtor entity basis of of cash flows, of historical financial performance, are the debtors in possession of those records?
Oh yes, it all consolidates within our records.
Okay.
So I can run balance sheet and statement.
If we take a look at the schedules for a group. Exhibit B, 14, which lists the debtors' investments in partnerships or joint ventures. I just want to get an understanding as to confirm what my understanding is of what's listed there. That's just the debtors' book equity investment in those respective entities. Would it be fair to say that the market value of those entities is basically tied to the fortunes of SCO? As SCO goes, so goes their investment in these various entities.
I would agree with that on all except for SCO China, which we only have a 30% equity in.
Okay. What is SCO China's business? What does SCO China have a business that's separate and distinct from its relationship with SCO?
No, I think that your original statement is still correct. I believe that even though we have less of an investment there, as SCO goes, still goes to the venture.
Okay. With respect to my next set of questions has to do with the impact of the litigation on this is what I'm trying to get at, and I think I'll frame it in a way that I can get a factual answer without getting into a sticky situation. Ask it, and then I'll let you jump on it. Let's just assume, and I appreciate the fact that the debtors disagree with
Judge Kimball's ruling in the Utah litigation, but let's just assume for a second that it remains where it's at.
Right.
In other words, that it would be it would become a final non-appealable judgment, and it would,
that would be it. Okay.
Judge Kimball was correct. What would be the impact on SCO's business? Well, first, let me just ask that general question, in fact, if you can answer that.
I'm not going to jump too much on the question because I think it was carefully asked. I will just note that obviously this is ongoing litigation. Counsel for one of the litigants is in the room today.
So I understand that.
We just need to be careful in terms of our response.
On top of that, this is a peculiar type. A 341 is an odd situation. It is sworn, it's under oath, but there's no judicial officer to pass on the relevancy or objectionability of any questions. But for whatever it's worth, I would pose an objection to the line of questioning, from as carefully crafted as it was, because it is ongoing litigation. It is beyond the typical scope of a 341 to talk about ongoing litigation that has, especially when in this case there's a pending motion by one of those litigants, which is crucial to the outcome of this case, motion for the default stay. Any statement that Mr. McBride makes today in response to that question or any follow-up question can be expected to be seen in court on November 6th or thereafter in course of within the bankruptcy litigation. So I hesitate to say that I direct him not to answer because I'm not sure what the consequences of that in this type of meeting is. But I strongly suggest that we steer something back to where we've been and away from where we're going.
Well, I appreciate counsel's view and, I guess, concern with where I'm going with the line of questioning. At the same time, like I said, I take the baby in the basket as I find it, meaning that my office has a duty to perform its oversight function. And the reality is that I'm dealing with a debtor with a cloud over it, regardless of whether or not the debtors agree that cloud should be there. And furthermore, the ability of the debtors to, I guess, comply with their obligations under Chapter 11 and successfully emerge from bankruptcy protection are conditioned upon getting some answers to these questions as to whether or not there is a viable, for example, whether there is a viable business here with this cloud hanging over them. How does our office not read and react to this bankruptcy case without getting an answer to that question?
Well, I think we can answer your question. I don't know whether the 341 meeting is the appropriate place venue for that. And I would also state that if the question is, has the debtor considered the various outcomes of the litigation that is pending? I think the answer to the question would be yes.
Okay. So then I can proceed with my questioning of the witness in that vein?
Well, I would echo the concern that we have because the litigant is here in the room. So
Regardless of whether the litigant were here in the room, they'd be able to get a copy of the tape. I mean, the reality is that I could take a 2004 exam rightfully and ask the same questions. Frankly, the scope of a 341 and the scope of a 2004 are not that distinct. So, I think I'm entitled to some latitude here, and I guess my question is, are you authorizing the witness to answer my question or not?
Well, you could request a 2004 examination, which we would have the opportunity to either agree to or oppose, depending on the nature of the inquiry.
I still have the same concern that was expressed regarding comments on the litigation that's pending. Do you want to ask a question?
Well, the problem really is, as Jamie's pointed out, not so much if the general question is, if you lose in the final analysis and a huge judgment is rendered on behalf of the opponent and our claims are entirely gutted, that's a lose-lose across the board. What's the impact? Not good. Okay. I mean, that question doesn't need even to be asked. But if that's the predicate to other questions, exploring those answers, well, how bad would it be? And what about this and what about that? That's where we really are sensitive, because the first question is innocuous, but it's the camel's nose. And that's why we're being so cautious now, Joe.
I'll skip over this for the moment. I just want to chew on it mentally, and then we'll come back to this at the end. But frankly, it's it is the critical issue. I mean, insofar as the debtor's having a viable chance to emerge from bankruptcy protection, and I'll come back to that.
Jamie's point was at an IDI when I didn't really know how it was running here, but I expected you'd be asking us questions like that in private, not on the record. And we could give you, but on the record is we're pretty sensitive to this.
Let me come back to that subject in a moment. Schedule F lists a $1.75 million obligation owing to operations. Do you have an understanding as to what that is?
I believe this is basically the same issue that we were discussing before, and I would get back to you.
So it's roughly, in fact, the amounts are roughly equal. It looks like it's a complete offset.
Yeah. That's why I was mentioning that it all zeroes out in the end. So.
Well, wait a minute. I'm already saying more than what I say here. It wouldn't be an offset, it would seem to me. It's a corresponding
right.
issue. One's
yes.
issue.
Yeah.
I mischaracterized it by just using a term to keep it straight in my head.
Yeah.
Regardless, we have a
payable on one.
An outstanding inquiry that you're going to get back to me
yes.
with respect to counsel's correct. My choice of words were, less than apt. The Schedule G lists a host of entities with what are described as independent contractor agreements
yes.
with purchaser. I'm just looking to get an understanding of what those are. Do you have an understanding?
Do you have a specific one you're interested in? I mean, there are different.
Well, there's a host of them, and they all have the same label. And I guess my question is.
Well, some of them, I can tell you that some of them are just simply past employees, engineers that we hire to help us with testing
okay.
and bug fixes.
Right.
Some of them are, I believe, Mike Olson and company are there. A lot of these are like little companies like Plum Hall, things like that. Once again, they're helping us in development. You know, someone like Shenyang Newsoft that is helping us in translating our mobility products into Chinese. Just different things like that that's outside of the scope of our current employees.
Okay. So they all have this common
I guess, label. What does the purchaser piece reply to?
What does the, I'm sorry, purchaser piece?
It's
like, meaning that...
In parentheses, purchaser after.
I think Mesro was attempting to designate between contracts where we're the purchaser as versus contracts where it's a customer agreement. I think that's what they were doing.
Okay. If we take a look at the statement of financial affairs for group. Response question number one is contractual agreements are generally made through the SCO group.
Mm-hmm.
It says, however, for accounting purposes, all revenue is invoiced and booked through SCO operations, a co-debtor in this jointly administered bankruptcy case. I guess my question is, do the debtors have the ability to break out whatever revenue or gross amount of income SCO group has?
No.
Individual? They do not.
No.
You report to the federal government on an annual basis for income tax purposes.
Yes.
And those, I guess those returns are consolidated, correct?
Correct. It's the SCO group and subsidiaries is the filing name.
Okay. And you do not break out groups, revenue, distinct from the other entities?
No. I do not believe we do. I believe it all rolls together, and that's what we report on in our federal taxes is to the SCO group and subsidiaries.
Okay. You're telling me that your accounting system, you do not have coding or an ability to run a cash flow statement for a SCO group?
No, because 90% of our transactions go under the entity that we basically consider as the U.S. entity, which is
operations?
Which is basically equals operations, yes.
Okay. But what about the other 10% of the stuff is my question?
Mostly what that is some of the is Japan, which is a separate subsidiary, and some of the small amounts of revenue that do go through the other subsidiaries for professional services, and just the intercompany revenues that come back and forth on that. So it's probably even less than 10%. I would say it's more like 5%.
Your answer is interesting just from the standpoint that, I mean, group is the public entity. Group is the entity that's, I guess, receiving equity infusions and the like.
Mm-hmm.
And from an accounting perspective, I can't imagine that there wouldn't be ability to record and recognize relationships between group and operations such that you will be able to account for what's going on with between the two entities as a business matter and also with equity holders' cash.
Not that I know of. I'll have to re-review, but
okay.
I believe everything is booked through the operational company and the group is used as a holding company.
Cattleback Holdings is referenced in number 10.
Mm-hmm.
And it references the transfer of a particular patent to that entity on July 18th. And I believe the Cattleback was formed on that day.
Yes, correct.
Can you explain to me what Cattleback is and what the patent is?
Patent is a systems management patent that we acquired when we bought a company back in, I believe it was 2001, called Acrylis. We bought it for the technology. It's an online updating technology. And it had this pending patent in 2001 that actually issued in 2003. Even though it issued in 2003, because of all the other things we had going on, there wasn't a lot of attention paid to it until earlier this year where we started looking at our intellectual property portfolio. We figured out this patent was sitting there. We had some initial work done on it and established that there was some value there. And at that point, we decided to try and sell the patent, and we retained an outside company called Ocean Tomo, a broker, if you will, of intellectual property, to go market this and sell it to somebody that would have interest in it. In the process of selling that patent, they recommended that we come back and sell it under a different brand than the Skull Group because of the litigation that was going on over there. They didn't want to cloud this issue with all of the other things in terms of what the intellectual property was, so we just basically formed this entity, Cattleback Holdings, as a mechanism to allow them to go market that patent.
Okay.
So that's the only asset that's in there. And it's just for that purpose.
Exhibit 18A references Me, Inc. Was that an entity formed by the debtors, or is that an acquisition?
That was formed by us. It's a wholly owned sub.
Okay. What was its business purpose, or what is its business purpose?
Its business purpose is basically an entity to put our mobility assets into. To date, we haven't actually transferred those in there, but it is set up. It is the marketing tagline, if you will, or the marketing moniker for our mobility product line. But because we don't have a substantial amount of revenue flowing there yet, we have not gone through the process yet of moving all of the assets into Me, Inc., but that is the... That has been and continues to be the plan.
Okay.
So right now, the assets of Me, Inc. and the liabilities of Me, Inc. are just booked under operations.
Okay.
May I inquire? Booked under operations or under group?
Well, it's in the same set of books with operations.
It rolls up under operations.
The U.S. entity.
Okay.
But the longer-term plan will be to split it off from operations, and at that point it would report into group. I mean, the entity reports into group right now, but I'm just saying operations of the people and the operations of the mobility product lines are still held under operations.
Okay.
And part of what we'd be trying to do going forward from a reorganization standpoint would be to place more emphasis on this.
Mm-hmm. Sorry about that.
That's no problem.
Off schedules now, I'm just asking some general questions. First, the debtors have bylaws, correct?
Correct.
Okay. And those bylaws provide for the appointment of officers, correct?
Yes.
Does the board have the exclusive authority to appoint officers, or do you know, or does the president, chief executive officer, have the ability to also have a right to designate officers? Can you tell me what the bylaws
are? My understanding is that it is a board function subject to shareholder confirmation.
Okay.
You're talking about directors or directors and officers?
Officers alone.
Oh, officers alone. I'm sorry. I was thinking of directors. Officers alone, I don't know the answer to that.
Okay. You don't have a specific recollection of appointing someone as an officer?
Not independent of the board understanding it, so that's where I'm not sure what the bylaws actually say.
Okay.
Let's put it this way. I have not appointed an officer without the board's involvement, so I'd have to track back and think. Well, the simply answer question is I don't know what the bylaws say with respect to the officer in question.
Okay. Do you know if the board ever appointed Mr. Olson as an officer?
Yeah, I believe Mike was an officer.
I'm sorry?
I'm pretty sure Mike was an officer.
Okay.
Yeah.
So there would be a board resolution or something to that effect that memorializes that?
Yes.
All right. I'd like to make a request for the bylaws, and to the extent that resolution exists, to copy that document. And for reasons that we're probably all aware of, I'd like to get that, if possible, by Monday. Okay, that's going to be a bit more. I'm going to put that request on a different track than the others, just because of the fact that the debtors are seeking various forms of relief in bankruptcy court, and I'm going to need to see that documentation.
Specifically with respect to Mr. Olson?
Correct.
That's the bylaws and the resolution of the board appointing Mike Olson as an officer.
Correct.
So two things.
Right.
Okay. Anything else?
That's it for right now. Right now, coming back.
No.
I mean, off on. You got it right, yes. Can you tell me whether, let me say, vice presidents are generally are considered, well, are officers under the debtor's bylaws as a general matter?
Generally, a vice president is not an officer.
Okay. Coming back to some, some of the other topics I wanted to go through. First, you appointed Mr. Nielsen as Chief Financial Officer, correct?
Yes.
Right, and he started work around the end of September, is that correct?
Do you know what day he started?
Yeah, it was. He was there before Bert left, of course.
I think our motion paper said October 1st.
Sounds about right.
Right.
Yeah.
But he was there just in order to get some training.
Yeah. And that agreement's been teed up before the bankruptcy court. I just want to, I guess I'll address my questions regarding that with you directly. The Burt Young consultancy agreement, that's referenced in a late September 8K filing. Is that the same independent contractor agreement that we've been discussing?
Yes.
It indicates Mr. Young is going to have a 6-month consultancy?
Yes.
Okay.
In fact, I should revisit the question you asked earlier with respect to how he's going to be paid. I think I said hourly. I think I do recollect now as you say that it was a 6-month contract.
Okay. The Tibbetts, the Tibbetts raised that was, I guess, disclosed in a recent 8K filing. The board approved that, I assume.
Yes.
The board ask for your input as to whether or not the raise and bonus were warranted?
Yes.
What was your what input did you give the board in that regard?
Hold on 1 second. I don't know whether our records of the compensation committee considered confidential in some regard. I mean,
yeah, that's a good point. I hadn't thought of that. Yeah.
Sometimes
a lot of companies do keep those as confidential.
Let me see if I can ask the question in a way that will get an answer that will not draw an objection from counsel. Do you have an understanding as to the reasons why Mr. Tibbetts was given a salary and a bonus?
He was given a salary?
No, I'm sorry. An increase in salary and a bonus.
My understanding was, as his boss, that he had been underpaid and under market for what we thought he should have been getting for some period of time. We were expecting to make adjustments in the fall time frame, and you know, the circumstances that we were giving him a raise in were different than what I were hoping they would be, which is we were going to be going into the courtroom and having a positive, successful outcome, and then coming back and saying, okay, we're going to revisit this issue. I know you've been paid for a while. We're going to take care of it now. The circumstances that we were under was one more of duress, and but it didn't change. So what was challenging for me was giving him a raise in the face of everything that we were going through, from a negative standpoint. But on the other hand, it was a situation that I felt like was warranted. The board felt that way as well.
Okay. Let me just get a back out here and ask some general questions regarding the operations. How many employees do the debtors have as of today?
As of today, I believe it would be 120-ish. 120.
Okay. It hasn't changed materially since the debtors' bankruptcy filings?
Not materially. Maybe a few have dropped off, but virtually not.
Okay. And
I believe that I recall reading in Judge Kimball's opinion, and you can correct me if I'm wrong, that the debtors have had I believe it's like one profitable quarter over the last, you know, I want to say like 5 or 6 years, and then it was the quarter in which they signed up certain agreements with Microsoft et al. Relating to its business. Is that correct?
I believe from a technical standpoint, that's probably a true statement.
Okay.
Well, can I inquire?
Yeah, can we?
Are you saying it's true that that's what the opinion said? Because that's what he asked you about.
Exactly.
What he said?
Well,
in other words, I mean, I'm looking at your historical filings, and I guess my question is, you've been running just on an operating basis. Have the debtors has Scale turned a profit in the last 5 years?
In the last 5 years, I believe it would just be that 1 year.
Okay.
But can I speak to that at a little bit more
sure.
granular level?
Sure.
We have incurred over $50 million of legal fees during that same time frame. Those $50 million of fees get lumped into this whole negative net income environment. And when I joined the company, just to give you a little bit of historical perspective, when I joined the company in 2002, we were sitting in a situation where we had several years of revenue decline. We right-sized the company. We had some layoffs. We got in a position where the operating business itself was actually generating cash. And over the last 3 or 4 years, if you look at operations, you will see cash flow coming out of that on a very consistent basis. What you will see negating that positive cash flow out of operations, and I say operations now, I'm talking the business of selling Unix, because everything's rolled up under operations. So let's just say the business of selling Unix has generated profits over the last 3 or 4 years. It's been the majority of the quarters that's generated profits. It's only been a few times that it hasn't. So why do we have negative net income? Two reasons. The first one is the fact that we had to make a decision whether we were going to fight for our intellectual property rights, and in taking that fight on, which eventually became a fight against the world, it became a very expensive proposition.
So again. Excuse me. We're back on the record. And I apologize for the interruption.
Yes, no problem. So the decision to fight for our intellectual property rights has been an expensive one. We've incurred over $50 million in that fight and continue to incur expenses. But we believe the damage that has been done to us is measured many multiples above that. And so that's where the majority of the negative net income has come from. The second thing that we did is we reinvested in the future platform of mobility to the tune of millions of dollars that is now ready to take off. And so at the same time, we're servicing customers that we've had for 20 plus years and fighting this other battle, we said it's important that we also have this future business proposition. If you took away the future business proposition investment and the legal damages case that we were trying to protect our rights, if you take those out of the picture, then you would have seen positive cash flow coming into the business of selling Unix and Unixware. But the problem was it was declining revenue, so the we had to do is match every quarter. We had to keep laying off and reducing and going down. So there is a picture there that if we don't get our day in court on the intellectual property rights, then we have a problem going forward.
If I were to just take a look at the quarterly report where it does break out the Unix revenue and expenses, there's a line for general and administrative.
Mm-hmm.
I'll just show it to you. And we're looking at the 10Q for the period ending 7/31. Would legal costs relating to the Novell litigation be racked up into that line item? Do you know?
I do not believe.
Let's see. What year are we talking about?
This is just the 7/31.
7/31.
Yeah. If this is just Unix, no, it isn't. The legal costs are rolled into what we call the SCOSource product line as a COGS to that.
Okay.
All right. So SCOSource is showing up over here.
Yeah.
Let me just see what the GI.
I think that's
accurate.
I understand what the witness is saying as a business manager. I just want to make sure I numerically understand what's going on.
Yeah.
With respect to taxes,
yes.
Are the debtors current on the, with respect to both their federal and state filings?
Yes.
Okay. And I gather you probably discussed an initial debtor reporting issues, including insurance with Mr. Panaccio prior to this meeting. A couple of things. First, our offices or the monthly operating reports that are required by the court. Mm-hmm. Did you have a chance to discuss those with Mr. Panaccio?
Yes.
And did you understand what the obligation is and the form it has to take?
Yes, and we've also hired Mesereau Financial to aid us with the first couple of months reporting.
I guess the question that I have based upon the testimony is whether we're going to be able to get separate breakout for both for group and for operations insofar as their operating results. And I gather that at least the debtor's immediate answer to that question is no.
Yeah, that's true. We cannot break it out as far as I believe.
Okay, well, we'll discuss that point internally
right.
And respond.
Good. Yeah, because most of it goes under operations.
I gather that you probably also discussed with Mr. Panaccio our office's quarterly fee obligations, and I'm not going to get into the calculation of them. Your counsel can assist you with that, but you're just generally aware of the obligation to pay them.
It was already rolled into our cash forecast.
I've had the chance to mull while I've been asking my questions, or I guess the line of questioning regarding where do we go. And while I think it would be possible to have that discussion on the record for a few reasons, what I would like to do is just set up a teleconference of some type where to walk through some of the questions I have regarding Schedule B from a timing perspective of this meeting. It's just not, as a practical matter, difficult. But we reserve our rights with respect to any future examination we may seek, including the 2004 examination, if we believe it's appropriate. But as a first step, I'd like to try a teleconference to get an understanding from the, just as the mechanically what the ruling means to scout.
I think that would be fine. We appreciate that, and we'd be happy to do that at your convenience.
All right. With that, I'm going to suspend my question and turn it over to counsel if there are any questions.
No questions.
Okay, thank you. There being no further questions, this matter is concluded. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
I've got a